I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the very first day of August. I'm back from a week in North Country, Minnesota. Did see all of the Republican National Convention the week before and saw one night and heard on the radio the other three nights of the Democratic Convention. So we'll be talking about that. Now we have both of them, and I'm interested in your thoughts about what you saw and what you heard and who inspired you and who didn't. We'll start with this hour, All Things Political, with a story that keeps making news, the appearance of Muslim Americans Khazir and Ghazala Khan at the Democratic National Convention. His characterization of Donald Trump, a black soul who is leading a campaign of hatred. Donald Trump's response about Mr. Khan and his wife yesterday, saying, well, he made some comments about his wife that have caused a lot of reaction. Yesterday, he said that Captain Khan, their son, killed 12 years ago, was a hero, but this is about radical Islamic terror and the weakness of our leaders to eradicate it. Today, Senator John McCain made a long statement about all of this. Hillary Clinton has received an increase in support after the Democratic Convention. 46% say they'll vote for her. 39% will back Trump, but it's still a few months from Election Day, and many are asking, can we learn anything from the polls? A federal appeals court in North Carolina striking down the voter ID law there, saying the provisions deliberately target African Americans with almost surgical precision. In Wisconsin, Judge James Peterson of Federal District Court ruled parts of Wisconsin's 2011 voter ID law are unconstitutional. He wrote, the Wisconsin experience demonstrates that a preoccupation with mostly phantom election fraud leads to real incidents of disenfranchisement, which undermine rather than enhance confidence in elections. And there was also a ruling on voter ID in Texas last week. What is Donald Trump's path to the 270 Electoral College votes? New York Times piece yesterday says it's Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. We have that and so much more to talk about. We got a busy time. The conventions are over, and now campaigning has begun. Our guest is Professor Kathleen Dolan, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. She is the author of When Does Gender Matter? Women Candidates and Gender Stereotypes in American Elections, and Voting for Women, How the Public Evaluates Women Candidates. We'll be welcoming your phone calls on the aforementioned topics this hour and whatever else you would like to discuss. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we like to read your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Kathleen Dolan, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, happy to be here.
We have a lot to talk about today.
It's been busy.
It's been very busy. Let's start with this story, which keeps making news. The families of a dozen service members killed in combat released a letter today criticizing Donald Trump for his criticism of the Khans at the Democratic National Convention. And he's been tweeting a lot, and he was on with Stephanopoulos over the weekend making comments about whether or not he has made sacrifices in his life and what his comments meant, particularly the comments about Mrs. Khan. Why is this a really big story, and why has it continued so much? And what do you think of the Khan's performance at the DNC and Trump's response?
Well, excuse me. I think that this situation, while, you know, at 30,000 feet, is sort of typical of the kinds of engagements Donald Trump has carried out over the course of his campaign. I think when you look at the specifics of this situation, it really is very different, and in some ways is almost a perfect storm of circumstances that may bring Donald Trump to finally having crossed a line. You know, the Khans were and have been incredibly eloquent in the last couple of days. Their appearance at the convention was seen as very genuine and heartfelt, and people had a lot of sympathy for them. For him to have attacked them, you know, after speaking out about the death of their son, I think began to resonate with people as perhaps a step too far. The Gold Star families have clearly come to the support of the Khans. There are many Republicans in the last couple of days who have come out. John McCain released a scathing statement this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Flake, the other senator from Arizona, supporting John McCain. So he's starting to see other Republicans take much higher profile. And I think that it's really in part the cons and how dignified and clearly in pain they were. It's the topic of our military service people sacrificing their lives. I think all of those things just really made a situation where he's gone too far in lots of ways, but this is one that I think the specifics are really resonating with
mm-hmm.
people.
And yet he said things about Senator John McCain, who was a prisoner of war for 5 years, and made comments about, you know, I like somebody who doesn't get caught, it doesn't get, you know, put in a prisoner of war camp.
Mm-hmm.
And those were thought to be incredibly sensational comments. People weren't very happy about what he said is about McCain, who is thought of as a hero by many, many Americans. It was a story for a while, and then it wasn't a story anymore.
Well, that's true. But John McCain, you know, after his service to our country and his time as a prisoner of war, is really most known to many people as a politician. And so at some level, I mm-hmm. think, even though lots of people did find the comments about Senator McCain reprehensible, I do think for a lot of people it was one politician talking about another politician. And it was much easier to sort of dismiss as sensational and political, you know, his comments. This is really him attacking a private family. I mean, they did choose to be part of the DNC. They did choose to stand and talk to the country and tell us about their son and his service and their sacrifice. And so they did willingly put themselves in the arena. But they are a private family. They're not politicians. They're not seeking anything for themselves. They're simply bringing attention to the fact that there are millions of Americans and millions of Muslims who are patriotic and who are appalled by Trump's comments. So I think it's really the private nature of a grieving family. You know, even after all these years, you could see their pain. And I think that's really what's offending most people.
What do you make of Paul Ryan's response, Mitch McConnell's response? Ryan evidently talked about it, saying many Muslim Americans have served valiantly in our military and made the ultimate sacrifice. Captain Khan was one such brave example, but he never mentioned Donald Trump and didn't condemn Donald Trump for making those comments. What kind of bind are some of these Republicans in?
Well, you know, it's fascinating to watch because Republican office holders and other Republican politicians really are having to make a choice. Speaker Ryan, you know, very clearly made his choice a few months ago when he came to peace or, you know, made peace or came to terms with Donald Trump's candidacy. His comment, you know, was really trying to thread that needle and, you know, speak in support of service families and the people who sacrificed their lives for our country and ignoring the Donald Trump piece because he doesn't want what might come, the blowback that might come from being critical of Trump. You know, Jeff Flake is one of the relatively few high visibility members of Congress, Republicans nationally, who has been consistent. Lindsey Graham, Senator from South Carolina, is another one. There are a couple of people who have been consistent in their criticisms and in their distancing from Donald Trump. But the number of Republicans, you know, who have joined them is very small. And people like Speaker Ryan and Senator McConnell are trying, you know, to have the best of both worlds. They're trying to be seen as supportive of military families, and they're hoping that by ignoring the Trump piece of this, people won't connect them in their minds to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the only ways that they can try, given what they've done to this point, to, you know, keep any damage from him away from their own careers.
As the audience knows, this is something that's been going on since Thursday night when Mr. Khan made his comments at the DNC, and then Donald Trump was tweeting over the weekend and had a fairly lengthy interview with George Stephanopoulos. I'm interested in hearing from the audience on this. In case you missed this story somehow, we wanted to play just a little bit of what Mr. Khan said at the DNC and later what Mr. Trump had to say on his interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC. So let's get a little bit of sound here, and we'll welcome your phone calls on this. We're going to move to other issues, but here's what, in case you missed it, you can hear now. Our phone number, your response to all of this, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Mr. Khazeer Khan now at the DNC.
Let me ask you, Have you even read the United States Constitution? I will gladly lend you my copy. In this document, look for the words liberty and equal protection of law. Have you ever been to Arlington Cemetery? Go look at the graves of brave patriots who died defending the United States of America. You will see all faiths, genders, and ethnicities. You have sacrificed nothing.
And this is what Donald Trump had to say to George Stephanopoulos on ABC over this weekend.
He was, very emotional and probably looked like a nice guy to me. His wife, if you look at his wife, she was standing there. She had nothing to say. She probably, maybe she wasn't allowed to have anything to say, you tell me, but plenty of people have written that. She was extremely quiet. And it looked like she had nothing to say. A lot of people have said that. And personally, I watched him. I wish him the best of luck.
He said, "You have sacrificed nothing and no one."
Well, that sounds, who wrote that? Did Hillary's scriptwriters write it?
How would you answer that, Father? What sacrifice have you made for your country?
I think I've made a lot of sacrifices. I work very, very hard. I've created thousands and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, built great structures. I've had tremendous success. I think
those are sacrifices.
Oh, sure. I think they're sacrifices. I think when I can employ thousands and thousands of people, take care of their education, take care of so many things.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm interested in your response to those comments and to all that the Cons had to say and what Trump had to say and what leaders like John McCain have had to say today. We're going to move on to, because we've got a lot to talk about this hour. Evidently, after the DNC, the Clinton campaign got a boost in their numbers, and it's about, 7 points, it looks like. A lot of people have been writing, Professor Dolan, that we just can't trust any polls at all. Do you trust that?
I certainly trust that Secretary Clinton received a bounce, as we call it, from the public opinion polls pre-convention to post-convention. When people say you can't trust any polls, that is sort of a typical cynical response that is, quite honestly uninformed about the industry and science of polling. Are there polls that we should not believe? Absolutely. Are there polls that are done poorly? Absolutely. I tell people all the time that public opinion polling is a science, and it needs to be done in a certain way to produce reliable results. Is any individual poll going to be accurate of something that's going to happen 4 months from now? No. What polls do is they give us a snapshot of what's happening at the time the polls were taken. So when we compare pre- and post-convention polls, we do see that Senator Clinton has increased support among independents, among Democrats, and even actually among Republicans a little bit. We can look and we can see, coming out of the RNC, we can see that Donald Trump had about a 3 percentage point bump. We can also see that much of that has eroded already. And so what we'll look to next week is to see whether perhaps Secretary Clinton's poll numbers have eroded a little bit. There's always that sort of, blush of the convention and the excitement. Or will they stay steady? We don't know. And so now what we'll do is sort of watch the polls as we go from here to Election Day and see how they are relative to each other. That gives us a sense of what the public is thinking, but the political scientist in me is required to remind everybody that that's not how we elect the president. And so the aggregate national public opinion polls are sort of an interesting gauge of what people's reactions are, but they tell us very little about really who's going to win the election, because presidents are elected state by state through the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm. Frank Bruni had an interesting column yesterday. He was talking about how Hillary Clinton needs to, in his words, calibrate her voice more deftly, stronger together. She can't forget how weak many Americans feel right now. Donald Trump incessant vows to make America great again and has Democrats responding that it's already great. Does that seem out of touch to a lot of people when, according to a recent poll, 56% of respondents preferred a candidate who would bring sweeping changes to the way government functioned because they're thinking that, you know, America's not quite on the right track?
Well, there's an awful lot going there. And one thing we have to remember is that the responses people give are to the question they're asked. And the question asked, you know, has a particular target, but that doesn't tell us an awful lot about what's underneath. So if we see public opinion polls that show that people, you know, a majority of people think the country's headed in the right direction, we don't know what they mean when they say that. Some people would say it's headed in the wrong direction because we have, you know, a Democrat in the White House. Some people could say that we're going in the wrong direction because the economic base of our country is changing too rapidly or whatever it is. So we can't necessarily take an individual finding and then surmise around that what people mean. There have been a couple of comments lately where people have suggested to the Democrats that at a time when people do seem to feel unsettled at best, you know, that optimism without reality is not the right play. I don't think that Secretary Clinton would argue that it was optimism without reality that she spoke about the other night, because she certainly did speak about the challenges that our country is facing. But given the, you know, almost dystopian tone of the view of America that came from the RNC convention, I think she wanted, and the Democrats wanted, to provide that contrast. How those two themes will play out, you know, from here on out is really probably going to be one of the major frames of the campaign.
Well, welcome phone calls. Professor Kathleen Dolan is our guest for All Things Political today. She is chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee, author of a couple books, When Does Gender Matter? Women Candidates and Gender Stereotypes in American Elections, and Voting for Women, How the Public Evaluates Women Candidates. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to a few phone calls, and our number is 800-486-8655. Drew in Gilman. Hi, Drew.
Hello, Kathleen and Kathleen. nice to talk to you.
And you as well.
So we all know George Stephanopoulos worked for Clinton, and he kind of still does, in my opinion. But my big question is, what in the world has Hillary Clinton sacrificed herself? And I know the professor can't speak for her, but, I mean, the question should be asked of both of them. And my opinion, Trump, no, he hasn't sacrificed anything, but neither has she. And that's my point that I'd like to make.
All right, Drew, thanks. Professor Dolan.
Well, I guess I would say the first thing is that Secretary Clinton did not attack the family of a fallen soldier. The question was asked of Donald Trump because it was raised in the context of the Khan's comment at the convention and then his response to them. So at a debate, if we see reporters asking questions of the candidates, you know, each receiving the same kinds of questions, those questions can be answered at some opportunity. But I don't think the question here is to ask what she has sacrificed. I think the question here is to ask why Mr. Trump engaged in this conversation. And I think the criticism he's been receiving is that it does seem to be indicative of a pattern of the way he attacks people and the way his personality works. So I guess I would say that would be my reaction.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about these voter ID laws, and I'm sure that some people in our audience will want to respond. Wisconsin, also North Carolina, and also Texas, if you want to start with Wisconsin. What does this mean? Do you think that these will all be appealed and there would be time for an appeal to reinstate the original voter ID laws before the November election?
I can't speak to how quickly these cases could move through the federal court system. The Supreme Court won't sit again until October, and they I can't think of a circumstance in which they could take a case and make a decision that quickly with only about a month of the term before the elections. So what might be more likely as appeals work their way up the food chain, whether or not the different circuit courts of appeals, whether the judges put stays on the laws or something like that, and that would be individual since they're coming from different districts. I think that one of the things that is very telling about the three decisions that came in the Wisconsin, Texas, and North Carolina cases is that the judges on the courts of appeal in the majority opinions are all citing intentional racial discrimination.
Yes.
And that will become part of the record as these cases move forward. And that will really make it very difficult for the Supreme Court to... So the first time the Supreme Court heard cases about voter ID and approved them, they did so with almost no data on the impact of those laws on the elderly, on minority populations, on the poor. That won't be the case this time. If they accept any of these cases that will almost assuredly come to them for a hearing, it will be virtually impossible for them to look at them simply as benign changes in law. They will have to address the discrimination piece because the judges below them are really writing that for them.
Judge Peterson really made a pointed decision saying that the provisions in Wisconsin's law deliberately target African Americans with almost surgical precision.
Yes, and there was a very similar sort of sense from the North Carolina decision as well. You know, in redistricting cases, I mean, the science of redistricting and the GIS data that are available to redistrict individuals or commissions, however it's done in different states, really does allow for, you know, block-by-block understanding of who lives where. And so when redistricting is done, it can be done with the surgical precision, you know, that the judge mentions and really can be used to create an outcome that you might desire. And so that's going to be one of the things that the Supreme Court ultimately might have to address is what could the motivation be, and is there evidence of an untoward motivation, or even absent motivation, is there clear evidence of a racial disparity in the impact?
Let's go to Tom next in Glenflora. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Okay, how are you?
I am just fine,
good.
Thank you. Beautiful day up here up north.
Good.
I would like to say that I believe that Donald Trump's position, well, I support him, although I voted for Obama. I'm a true independent. I voted for George W. Bush, and I voted for Obama both. I believe that Donald Trump's position is a response to two things. Number one, the fact that the Obama administration has refused to call Islamic terrorism, and whether we want to call it that or not, the people who are instigating it, that's what it is to them. And therefore, I think we should use their term for it. Secondly, I think his position is part of the fact that from France to Belgium to the United States, we have not been able to deal with the people who have used our freedoms to infiltrate our country and cause us damage. And so I think his approach is somewhat pragmatic in that extent, that until we can fix that, we have to put the brakes on a little bit.
Professor Dolan.
I would, I guess, make a couple of comments. The first is certainly something that other people have said. This is not original to me. But if the president were to use the phrase Islamic terrorism, it changes absolutely nothing about anything in the world. That doesn't speak to tactics. It doesn't speak to plans or policies. It speaks to a desire among some people in this country that he label it that way. It is a meaningless phrase at some level. So his uttering that word does not, or failing to utter those words, does not in any way suggest that he is not committed to protecting our country. I think the second thing is that one of the things we struggle with as a political society is that we have had very little success lately dealing with homegrown terror. And by that I mean, you know, Americans who have used guns in committing crimes against our country internally. So terrorism can take many forms. Violence can take many forms. There may or may not be different ways of stopping it, but I don't think that... I think that there are larger societal problems here, whether it's a conversation about guns or a conversation about, you know, background checks or understanding, you know, who the people who become radicalized, whether it's radicalized over Islam or radicalized over some, you know, personal ideology. I think we don't understand a lot of those dynamics, and I think there are not simple solutions.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of both conventions' response to terrorism in this country and also abroad? Was there a plan that somebody in one of the conventions outlined that seemed to be thorough?
Well, I guess I will say that there was not a lot of specificity along those lines. I mean, you know, terrorism is a world of problems and possible solutions that are not visible to us on a day-to-day basis because of their complexity and their secrecy. I guess I will say that I join many people who thought that Donald Trump, you know, did not lay out many specifics on anything, never mind, you know, international sorts of things. But I think you could certainly say that Secretary Clinton, other than articulating the same, you know, desires that Donald Trump did to protect the country, also wasn't laying out specifics. I think that that's going to be a place in the campaign where it might be harder for the candidates to talk with specificity, harder certainly than to talk about education or environment or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, they're, you know, incredibly complex problems and there aren't single solutions.
How important are the conventions? I guess, you know, millions and millions of Americans watched, more watched the Democratic convention as a whole, but more watched Donald Trump than watched Hillary Clinton, which I found interesting. Does that mean anything? And are those conventions important in really securing some votes?
Well, you know, we still see the conventions as important. I mean, they've changed over time, certainly, and the amount of attention they get from the media is sort of less than more, if only because of the incredible segmentation of our media environment. You can avoid them if you want to, like in the old days you couldn't. But they certainly are important. They introduce the candidates and the people around the candidates to lots of people who hadn't been paying attention to the political race. So they certainly bring, you know, sort of fresh viewers and fresh people to be convinced. I think that the ratings per se, you know, that the Democrats had higher ratings, but Donald Trump's speech did, you know, I don't think those things are meaningful in and of themselves. The ratings difference wasn't huge on either of those scores. I had actually seen something this morning that said that Donald Trump's speech did receive higher ratings than did Hillary Clinton's, but that Donald Trump's speech was seen overwhelmingly negatively by something like 70% of the people who watched it. So reaching more eyeballs if you make them sad is not a good outcome. So, you know, they're certainly important. They're introducing the candidates, as I said, to lots of new people. And I think what will be important out of this one, this set of conventions is, you know, the shorthand coming out was that the Republican convention was relatively chaotic, not particularly interesting, and very dystopian. And I think overall people thought that the Democrats ran a good convention.
Mm-hmm.
They handled the, you know, sort of internal loyalty issues, you know, with the Bernie Sanders supporters about as effectively as they could have. And they came out, you know, with a more optimistic sense of life. And so those, I think, are the shorthands that are going to resonate in people's minds. And those messages and those shorthands can matter.
I was surprised, considering his background in television and putting together a really good show, that the Republican convention really had some second-rate speakers. He was hopeful, I think, that a lot of sports stars were going to show up. And instead we had people from, I don't know, wrestling TV things that he had helped them out and TV shows that I didn't know anything about. He wasn't really successful in lining up some extraordinarily powerful and inspirational speakers.
No, I think that's right. And I think one thing to remember is that even though, you know, he says he has a lot of experience doing this, he doesn't produce The Apprentice himself. He doesn't produce the Miss USA pageant himself. I mean, you know, he doesn't have experience producing these, you know, mega television events. So, you know, that at some level was his hyperbole. But I think the fact that, you know, Scott Baio and Antonio Sabato Jr. were, you know, about the highest visibility celebrities he could get to be on the show speaks to the same dynamic that Republican politicians are going through. You know, there were rumors that Bobby Knight was going to appear and Tom Brady and, as you said, all these sports stars, and everyone, Tim Tebow, and every one of them said, no, actually, no, I'm not going. And that's in part because I think celebrities, just like politicians, worry about their brand, and people are not sure what direction this is going to take, and they're not sure how being associated with him could hurt them or could help them, and I think they're just not willing to take the risk.
And what about you? Are you unsure as to what direction this is going to take?
Sure, yes. I mean, you know, as I've said a couple of times, every political scientist I know did not see, that's not true, I should say, there's one or two people who saw the Trump phenomenon right. unfolding, but most of us did not. You know, this election really has defied many of, you know, the sort of, not the fundamentals, but many of the possibilities, you know, that we could have seen. I guess I think that it is the case that if we focus on the fact that the Electoral College is how we elect the president, the odds of Hillary Clinton winning are higher than the odds of Donald Trump, simply because when we look at the map and when we look at the states, you know, the number of what we call the battleground states is actually going to be shrunk. It's going to be a little smaller this year than it has been in years past. There are a couple of states like Wisconsin, Colorado, you know, that seem to be less swingy than they were in the past, and so if you live in, you know, five or six of these states in the United States, your life is going to be hell for the next 4 months. but that's really, you know, where the election is probably going to come out, unless there are crazy circumstances, you know, that can always appear in a campaign. You know, I guess we feel fairly confident that we know how many of the states are going to vote, and, you know, the question of presidential elections is, how are those unknown states going to vote?
Mm-hmm. The Times, I'm sure you saw, had a piece yesterday saying that he simply had to win Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania
right.
being one of those states that hasn't voted Republican since 1988
right.
in order to secure enough votes. Would you agree with that analysis?
Yes, yes. I mean, there are fewer paths than more for Donald Trump to get to 270 votes, and his clearest path, you know, his most direct path would always include those three states. And that is, you know, unknown at this point, certainly, but that is not a terribly easy path because Florida, while kind of a swing state, you know, has been kind of a swing state in the way that Wisconsin has been. I mean, Wisconsin hasn't voted for a Republican for a presidential nominee since 1984. But yet, for the last couple of elections, people have still seen us as kind of a battleground state, even though in the end we really weren't. You know, Florida could be considered that way. Certainly Pennsylvania and Ohio, you know, people say Ohio is the kind of true classic swing state, and, you know, fine. But he does have to win those three, and winning those three would be challenging for a Republican.
Hmm. Let's go next to Keith in Green Bay. Hi, Keith.
Good afternoon, ladies. I watched the George Stephanopoulos interview with Trump, and I think it shows what a shallow, cowardly liar he is when he equates that he built great structures and employed a lot of people with the death of a family's son. It shows really the shallowness of his personality. Donald Trump doesn't build. He takes advantage of other people's talents. He puts his name on things and takes credit and then screws the little guy with lawsuits because he doesn't want to pay them. I don't want that kind of a person as the representative, as the leader of my country. It shows just what kind of moral bankruptcy the Republican Party has sunk to. It infuriates me. And I understand why people might have watched the Republican convention. It's like watching a train wreck. It's like slowing down to watch a bloody car accident than something that has a real value.
Professor Dillon.
Well, you know, I guess I would say that Keith's comments clearly show the degree to which Donald Trump is not a politician. And by that I mean that a more sort of successful politician would never have attacked the Kahn family in the way that he did. But the response, you know, that he could have made to the sacrifices question is, I don't know that family's pain. I haven't made those sacrifices. The military was not a part of my path. And he, you know, an honest politician who wanted to sort of, you know, put the damage behind them would have found a way to say, you know, you're right, I can't and won't put my life and my life experience on the same, you know, level with Sergeant Kahn's. I mean, it just, it can't be done. But Donald Trump's personality seems to show an inability to sort of take that more, perhaps, approach of humility, which then continues the story and leads to, I think, you know, what for him might be bigger problems down the road than he needed.
Keith, thanks for the call. And Donald Trump evidently is going to be in Green Bay on Friday.
Yeah.
We haven't. The criticism of the Democratic convention was that before they started, it was imperative that they have a vision, that they concentrate on certain points, and these are the themes. This is what we're campaigning on. The criticism after the convention was that the Democratic convention was too many things to too many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, that's always a criticism people make of the Democrats, because when they think about sort of the stereotype of Democrats, they think about, you know, a party that is trying to serve many constituencies all at once.
Right.
You know, certainly if you read a lot of the commentary that's, I mean, there was just a scathing story, you know, in I think it was on the Washington Post today, about how the Republicans have become the party of white racism. And I am not in any way articulating that, but what I'm saying is that view of the narrow nature of the Republican Party, you know, is one of the frames. The reverse of that is that people see the Democrats as, you know, sort of bending over backwards to hit every constituency they can.
Right.
And I think the Democrats, that is their shtick, right? I mean, they are the rainbow of, you know, coalitions. So if you were critical of that, that might be because you don't see that as your particular taste. There are lots of, you know, Democrats who believed that the party's best advantage is to show its outreach to lots of people who are often marginalized. So, you know, there isn't a right or a wrong. The parties are very different on these scores, and people choose, right, the party that identifies their feelings more.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. You're listening to All Things Political, which we always have on Mondays. We'll do a lot more political shows, of course, with the presidential election in a mere, well, a little over 3 months away. Our guest is Professor Kathleen Dolan. She is chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of When Does Gender Matter? Women Candidates and Gender Stereotypes in American Elections and Voting for Women, How the Public Evaluates Women Candidates. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go back to phone calls for Professor Kathleen Dolan and John in Madison. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
And Professor, proud UW-Milwaukee alum, so thanks for sharing our perspective in the UW system with everybody else. But I just want to say, first of all, I'm so disappointed, and I'm more likely now watching the convention to vote for Hillary Clinton, although I did vote for Sanders in the primary. And I can't believe how bad I feel for people who generally vote Republican or are good conservative people who, this is their candidate. I mean, this is the guy carrying their banner around the country and now talking down to military veterans, fallen soldiers, their families. I don't think that this is what most people stand for. And I just wanted to say, as a Democratic voter, mostly really feel bad for people who vote Republican, one of the two great American parties. That's my comment. Thanks so much.
Yeah, what does Trump do to the party?
Well, so first I'll say go Panthers. And then second, I will say that this election year, the primary election year here, has been a just astoundingly perfect example of the degree to which the political parties in the United States have had an increasingly difficult time in defining who can be a candidate under their label. So Donald Trump decided he was a Republican. He decided he was going to run in the Republican primary. There was nothing that anybody who is a Republican could do to keep him out. As long as he was able to achieve ballot access in the 50 states, he could choose to be a Republican. In the same way that Bernie Sanders, right, who has always identified as an independent, said, for me to be a viable candidate for president, I need to run in the Democratic Party. We have seen in the last 2 weeks David Duke, the former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, announce his candidacy for a U.S. Senate seat in Louisiana. You have to know that the Republican Party in Louisiana is not delighted by this. But political parties have really, over the course of the last 40 or 50 years, lost a lot of their ability to shape who their candidates are. So that's been a continuing theme we've seen in this primary season, right? It's Trump's party now. People keep saying he's the Republican, he's what Republicans stand for. I think people like Senator Flake and Senator McCain and you know, a couple of other people are saying, no, there is a Republican Party that exists independent of this candidate who happens to have come into our party at this time. But those are real problems for political parties when they get non-traditional candidates who may not fit perfectly under their umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we completely forgot. So much has happened since then to talk about the DNC less than savory remarks about Bernie Sanders and the hacking of the email by maybe the Russians. We don't know for sure. And understandably, Sanders supporters were upset by that. Do you think most of them have forgiven the DNC now? Does the DNC change the way it operates as a result of all of this?
Well, so, you know, let me say one thing, given that we're talking about political parties here. The Democratic National Committee is the governing body of the Democratic National Committee. People can say that, you know, Debbie Wasserman Schultz should have had greater bipartisan nature, if you believe that that's what it was. But the Democratic National Committee wanted to choose the best Democrat to run for president. It's not unusual, and it's not crazy for us to expect that a party will want its own goals. On the other side, you know, Rents Priebus and the Republicans were very torn about, should they, you know, protect the party? Should they try to stop Donald Trump? Should they let Donald Trump in? It's clear on the other side that the Democrats had a clear sense of who they wanted to be their candidate. Again, Bernie Sanders, not a Democrat. So if there were two people who were lifelong Democrats, I think the party structure, and I think Debbie Wasserman Schultz, would have had much more even-handedness. Now, did they do the right thing? No. Did they do the right thing in all circumstances? No. But what we have to remember is that political parties exist to win elections, right? And they make strategic choices about what they want to do and what ends they want to achieve. So that the Democrats were in that party were more weighted in favor of the actual Democrat, you know, I mean, at some level, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how surprised we should be by that.
Thanks, John, very much for your call. Miguel in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I just want to maybe correct the professor on one thing. It's Captain Khan, not Sergeant Khan.
Thank you very
much. And the other thing, since we're going short on time, the other thing is when Joe McCarthy, the rabble-rousing senator from Wisconsin, was before the Committee on Un-American Activities, the council asked him, "At last, sir, have you no decency?" That's all I have.
All right. Thanks, Miguel, for your comments. Josie in Sheboygan. Hi.
Yes, hi. I've said all along since he first came on the scene as a candidate, Trump, that he is just spewing what Republicans really think. Everything, the way they vote against poor people and all that, they've been like that forever. And all the other, I heard Glenn Grossman this morning, and he is so despicable talking about the Voting Act, you know, how he's so outraged at that judge, that activist judge, you know, is overturning it. And then also, the man that wrote The Art of the Deal for Donald Trump, mm-hmm. he was with him for 18 months, and he was said that in an interview, I didn't hear it, but I heard it on the radio, that he thinks he's a sociopath. And I agree, because that guy is just, he makes no sense. You know, he has not a caring bone in his body, you know, other than himself. I don't know why people don't see it. I think half the country has gone insane. They're so mad at the politicians, and also Democrats and Republicans, not doing the people's work. I mean, it's just, that's how all this happened.
Thanks, Josie, for your call. Professor Dolan.
Well, Josie clearly has very deeply held beliefs about this election, and we're going to hear a lot of those things on both sides. You know, one of the things we know about elections in the United States is that the number of people who can be convinced is pretty small. People come into, you know, this point in an election cycle with a sense of who they support and who they don't. They may have a political party identification already that's going to shape their actions, and there's probably not much that, you know, Donald Trump or a Republican could say that would convince Josie to think about supporting him, just as, you know, there wouldn't be much that Hillary Clinton can really do to move Republicans. So, you know, the campaigns are talking in ways that they want to help shore up their supporters and then try to talk to that, you know, relatively smaller group of people who remain unconvinced of either side yet.
Hmm. So what happens? Josie talked about the Republican Party, but there were 21 Republican senators who didn't show up for the convention. There were former Republican presidents who didn't show up for the convention. There are a lot of not extreme Republicans who are concerned about the direction of the party. Where are they this election?
They're home campaigning in their own districts and states. You know, one of the things that the Republicans, I think, are worried about, and with some justification, is whether or not they're going to have a turnout problem in the fall, because there are fewer of the major party leaders who are really going to be out there on the stump with Donald Trump. You know, after the DNC, the president, the vice president, the first lady, Hillary Clinton, Tim Kaine, you know, the top Democrats in the country all went out in a wave. After the Republican convention, there was nobody. You know, Trump and Pence are sort of out there by themselves. So a lot of these Republican politicians who may not want to take Trump on publicly and say, we repudiate you, are quietly going about the business in their own states.
That's
they're
interesting.
Running their own campaigns. They're trying to get turnout in their own states, because whether or not Donald Trump wins the presidency, there are, you know, thousands of Republicans down ballot who are running for Congress and state legislature and governor and all sorts of races. And the party has to worry about those candidates, too.
And will the Democrats have a turnout problem?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that they came out of the convention with relatively high excitement. You know, despite what was made of the Bernie Sanders supporters and some of their protests, the sort of coming together of the party, the Bernie Sanders supporters are coming to Hillary Clinton at almost a faster rate than the Clinton supporters went to Senator Obama in 2008. So there's actually almost, you know, a little bit more unity at this point in the election process. So I don't think the Democrats are as worried about unity as the media might want people to believe. I think they feel like they had a good convention. They've got a strong candidate. And, you know, I think they're feeling good about turnout in the fall.
Thank you, Professor Dolan, for being with us.
Sure.
We'll chat again. We got months to go.
We sure do.
All right. Thank you. Professor Kathleen Dolan, professor and chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. Her research interests, American government, women in politics, and elections and voting. And she is the author of When Does Gender Matter? Women Candidates and Gender Stereotypes in American Elections and Voting for Women, How the Public Evaluates Women Candidates. We have news coming up. First of all, I want to thank KP Whaley for producing this hour and Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Hour two of our program should be a very interesting show. Our guest has studied extensively African-American soldiers in World War I, and he's written about the soldiers, both of whom were vets, who did the horrendous shootings in Baton Rouge and in Dallas, and looks at the military experience and what happened to them after they came home from service. So That should be a good conversation, enlightening conversation, which you will hear momentarily.